this week on Dig Me Out with your hosts, Jason Ziak, Tim Minichi, and Chip Midnight.
Jay, we're back again with another episode thanks to our Dig Me Out Union on Patreon. You can help us make the next episode happen by joining us at dmounion.com or digmeoutunion.com. And joining us, coming back to the show, as if we hadn't spoken to him in such a long time, but in fact, that's a lie, Chip Midnight's back, and he's back with an interview. Hi, Chip.
Back with an interview. It's been a little while. The interview is with Monique Powell from Save Ferris.
And we talked about them way back, episode 347 in 2017, Before Times.
Season 7.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know if you guys remember, but you did like it. And I think you even talked about how it was the first ska punk album you reviewed. And so you'll hear in the interview, I mentioned that to Monique. I will say the one thing that I missed in the interview, and it was because I thought she probably was sick about talking about it, but it turns out that she said that there's a lot to the story that hasn't been shared. And I don't know the whole story, so I'm going to give the abbreviated version, is that in the early 2000s, basically Save Ferris broke up as the band members left. However, those band members started their own band, and there became these lawsuits back and forth over the name, over who owned the social media handles. It's been pretty messy. Again, I thought that this is something that she has talked about ad nauseum in the press and didn't want to talk about, but she says in the interview, no, I haven't talked about a whole lot. There's still a lot to tell. I, in a bad journalistic move, did not press further. I apologize about that. But at this point, I believe she owns the name Save Ferris. She's going to be putting out more music as Save Ferris. She performs as Save Ferris. And I think what came out of all this is she was able to kind of go back and get songwriting credits for things that she was not giving credit for in the initial run of the band. And so,
wow. That's pretty
rare. All I'm going to say, since I didn't do my homework, you can Google it and see if you can find more information about what's going on. But it was a fun interview. She's a lot of fun. She is excited to keep the name going and is playing some shows, popping up a lot more on the West Coast, which is where she's from. And given the fact that it's 2024 and, you know, 20 years past when Save Ferris started, and, you know, like a lot of these bands that are covered on the Dig Me Out 90s podcast, there's not a lot of money in touring right now. So she's doing a lot of these ska festivals that Save Ferris gets to play a lot of. So she's staying active, but just maybe not going to hop in a van and crisscross the country anymore.
Right. Do one-off kind of things.
Sure. Yep. Makes sense.
I did ask her one thing, you know, and again, I mentioned this in the interview, and I'm sure she probably gets tired of answering this question, but you'll hear the answer to whether or not anybody from the Ferris Bueller movie is aware of Save Ferris, and if so, kind of what they've said about the band.
Oh, cool.
You know, there's a sequel coming out.
No,
not a sequel. There's a movie being made about the two guys from the parking garage who take the Ferrari and go on a joyride while Ferris and his friends and him, and they go to Chicago. Do you remember that part of the movie?
Yeah? Sure. I didn't realize that their story needed to be told.
Their story was so important. You don't understand what went down with them and that car.
I guess. Okay.
So they're going to make that into a whole movie.
God. Okay.
In case you're wondering what sort of IP needs to be mined for future content. There you go.
Never cross. Sometimes when you watch a movie, you're like, oh, I wonder what happened in that. You know, these people went off and did something. It'd be kind of fun to see what happened. That never occurred to me watching that movie.
No. Or you watch a movie and you're like, the side characters are more interesting than the main character.
Yeah,
you're like, I want that person's story.
Like the Boba Fett series and that kind of stuff. But yeah,
I thought
about the parking garage guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we're wrong. What do we know?
What do we know? We're not executives in mansions. Right. So we're not there. Well, Chip,
just doing a little podcast.
Thank you for doing this interview. And let's get to Chip's interview with Monique Powell from Save Ferris.
When So I know that, that you originally, you put out, like you, you independently put out an EP.
Mm-hmm.
And that caught some attention from mm-hmm. labels and from DJs and from you know, radio programmers and stuff.
Yeah.
Was the dream to sign to a label, or were you pretty happy with what you were doing on your own?
Well, in the 90s, the dream was to get signed to a label. And you know, that dream happened. It came yeah. true. And we got all the things out of being on a label that we could get, all the financing and the publicity and the promotion and the touring and all of that. And now that I'm not on a label, and people are mostly releasing things on their own, you know, there's been a little bit of a learning curve for me, but it's fun. It's actually very fun. You know, at first I was scared. I was like, how am I going to do this? You know, and now I'm actually really enjoying it.
Yeah. So, so the EP, the first EP, this First Save Ferris EP came out in 95.
Yes.
Ish.
95, 96. Yeah.
Like I mentioned before we started, you know, the 90s are a little bit of a hazy memory. I remember like highlights and stuff. Do you remember like where you were in 1990? Like how did you roll into the 90s leading up to the first EP? I mean, were you always a musician? Were you playing in bands and it eventually, you know, worked its way into Save Ferris, or was that something that kind of started in the 90s?
Well, strangely enough, I actually started out as an opera singer.
Oh, wow.
And when I was like 11 years old, I wanted to be a singer. I wanted to be a pop singer, actually, but I ended up getting into opera and I really loved it. And I was fairly good at it. And I won some stuff that helped me get into college. And, you know, and I went to college and I was studying opera, but in like 1992, 1993. And that's when I got into a band. Was then when I was living in Fullerton, in Orange County, and all my friends were getting into bands. And I was like, okay, they were like, you're a singer. We have a band. We need a singer. Why don't you get into the band? And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But prior to that, in like 1990, I was in college and I was going to arts school. I went to arts high school and I was doing mostly musical theater in those days.
In the night, like, did you fall into the whole grunge thing, the Nirvana thing? Were you into that kind of music?
I mean, I love Nirvana. There's no not loving them, but I was always more into punk, to be honest. Really? You know, like my sister is 11 years older than me, and I was a product of her musical influence when I was a kid, and that's how I got into ska. Was, you know, listening to the Specials when I was, you know, like 7, 8, 9 years old. And yeah, Sex Pistols and Black Flag and all of them. So for me, I was more into punk.
Was Save Ferris the first band you were in, or did you do other stuff?
I was in other bands first. Yeah, I was in a band called Larry, we played with a lot of ska bands. We were not a ska band. We were more of like a eat acid and sing about Star Wars kind of band. And we listened to Frank Zappa all the time and sang about Yetis and things like that. We were super weird, but we played with all these ska bands because they were all our friends. And then I was also in an all-girl ska band called the Shanties. It was a very traditional 60s, like 60s influenced first wave ska band. And what else? I think that's it. And then Save Ferris.
I did not have the benefit of having older siblings. I had friends who had older siblings, and one of my friends, his sister had gone, I lived in Connecticut at the time, and my friend's sister went to Pepperdine. So she went all the way across the country. And so we basically raided her record collection. And so like I grew up on classic, what's now classic rock, you know, everything from Ozzy Osbourne to Journey to the Police to REO Speedwagon. I think the closest I got to ska was probably when Madness put out Our House, you know, like that yeah. was the closest thing at the time.
Yeah.
The thing about Madness and about ska that I've kind of learned throughout the 90s when I started listening to more bands was it just seems to be sort of fun. I mean, there's like, you know, grunge was the complete opposite of that, right? It was dour, looking down at your shoes. It was wearing heavy clothes and ska just seemed to be fun. Is that as much then and now of an appeal of the music to you as it is performing it? I mean, do you have fun doing it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I always say to people, like, if you're not sold on the albums, just come to a live show. Like, we will sell you on our band and on our music if you just see us perform it, because our shows are literally so much fun. They're just, you know, they're a little naughty and kind of adult, but then also people get to remember what it was like to be a kid in the 90s, some people. And then there's a lot of young people that come to our shows who are just now getting into ska, you know, and they just want something to dance to, really. And yeah. So we bring that to the masses. We have a saying, ska now more than ever.
That bumper stickers and t-shirts. With that,
yeah.
That on? Yeah. Awesome.
We made that up.
That is awesome. I love it. So
yeah.
So how did Safe Airs come together? Was it a group that was already formed and you were brought in, or did you help form it? Or like, tell me about how the band first came together.
Yeah, it was just some guys that went to high school together that were part of our scene they were in a band that was opening for Larry, yeah. And they lost their singer. They had a band under another name. And they lost their singer, or I don't know if they let her go or not, but when I was singing in Larry, they called me and asked me if I wanted to be in their band. And I wanted to be in a ska band again, because I really like being in the shanties, but I wanted to be in a third wave ska band because all my friends were in third wave ska bands. And it was kind of like the closest thing to punk, like that was like acceptable for a girl to do in those days. And I just wasn't in the place that I am now, where I would just be like, F you to the masses. At that time, I was like 19 and still wanted everybody to like me and think I was pretty, you know? Yeah. Yeah. So it was like, I want to be in a ska band, third wave ska. Because I also knew that like every once in a while we'd play with punk bands and stuff. And so I was like, cool. And they had a couple songs already. And I said, cool, I'll, you know, do the old songs with you, but all the new songs I want to co-write. And I want to manage the band until we get on our feet. And I did. And we put out our first demo, a couple songs on there. And it's funny, because on the cassette tape, it says, for booking, call Monique. It's got the old phone number on there. Just really cute. Yeah. And then my sister financed our first EP. We were not signed. We just kind of organized ourselves like our own like distribution and our own art department and our own, all of that. And yeah. And then it just kind of took off.
So as a 19-year-old, were you pretty like connected to the scene, or were you just like kind of cold calling and dropping demo cassettes in the mail and hoping that somebody would call you back? Or did you have good connections at places?
Part of me kind of thinks that's why they asked me to be in the band, because I was fairly well connected at that point. Yeah. I was just friends with everybody. And yeah, so it was fairly easy for me to manage the band in the beginning.
Do you remember in those days? I was talking to a guy recently who is Harry Styles' guitar player.
Uh-huh.
And he put out his own solo record. And I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and he's from Columbus. And I didn't know him, but I saw him perform in his early bands. And he told me that, like, in those days, his dream was to play the club that held 200 people. And now he plays stadiums. When you were starting out, was a dream to play like the next biggest place in LA, or did you have the dreams of really like headlining Madison Square Garden or playing something big, or was it like whatever the next biggest venue is would have been at that time the big dream?
I think all my dreams came true. I got to play Madison Square Garden. I didn't headline it, but
sure.
You know, I got to play festivals for almost 100,000 people. And, you know, we did get to headline the Palace and the Palladium and the Whiskey and all the clubs in LA that were sort of iconic for me growing up here. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know, like maybe the Hollywood Bowl, maybe. I mean, I've played the bowl, but I haven't headlined it. That would be nice to be able to headline the Hollywood Bowl.
But when you were starting out, I mean, was that we want to be as big a band in the world as we can be, or was it like we just want to be the biggest local band, or we just want to play the place that holds 200 people? I mean, did you have those sort of sights?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you set your sights on the next biggest thing, keep it realistic and all of that. But secretly, I really wanted us to play bigger venues and headline them, of course. Yeah.
Were you like practicing in front of your mirror? Like when you had that, when that day came that you would be prepared?
When I was a little kid with my hairbrush.
Yeah.
The hairbrush was my microphone.
Yeah. I had a hairbrush microphone and a yardstick guitar were my,
oh really?
In front of the mirror. Pretending to be different people. Yeah, that was definitely
adorable.
Yeah. So 95 rolls around and you signed to Epic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And were other labels kind of coming out and checking you out and offering you stuff, or was Epic the one that kind of made the first move?
Yeah, there were a few others. I can't remember who, but we went with Epic because for whatever reason, I mean, in those days, like we didn't know what we were doing. And we didn't realize that, like, manager at that point, we had a manager that wasn't me.
Yeah.
And we realized at that point, well, because we were already being played on alternative radio here, like on K-Rock, and we didn't have a label or a manager at that point. Like, so we had to get a manager, and then the record label started sort of coming around. And we, like, you know, you don't realize that, you know, at that point, a manager just wants you to sign for the most amount of money so that they can get paid, you know, and you don't realize that, like, you know, all that money that the label is giving you, you have to pay back. And after you pay that money back, you still don't own 85% of your record. It was like the most crooked, thuggish, like, gangster bullshit ever. And they were just taking advantage of kids. You know, they loved it. They loved that we were young, and they loved like handing us a 200-page contract and being like, you get everything you've ever wanted, sign here. We're like, of course, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, there were like other labels and stuff. I don't know if they would have been better for us or not, but no, like I said, we got what we needed out of it.
Right. Did you know at the time that they were taking advantage of you? I mean, there's been a lot of like books and I've talked to a lot of artists from the 90s who will say mm-hmm. the same thing you did, that, you know,
yeah,
they had stars in their eyes and they were being handed everything they wanted. And then the reality hit and, you know, it's a good story to tell future generations. So you didn't really know that was all going on. You were just happy to see your CD in the store and get tour support and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I looked at it like this, you know, no bank was going to give us a loan for like $2 million, you know, like yeah. None of us ever owned anything in our lives at that point yet. So this was just, you know, the way that we would be able to get the financing that we needed to be able to reach the world with our music and our shows. And for me, that was what mattered most. You know, it's okay. Like it didn't affect my, like we paid back the loan already, you know? And yeah, they like own the masters, but like, who cares? You know, who cares at this point? There's so much new stuff coming out already, you know, for Say Ferris that it's like that old stuff is great and people love it, but the new stuff is gathering a lot of traction. So, and I own it.
Yeah.
So it's mine.
So like, I know when I was growing up, you know, watching 70s and 80s artists and sort of the glory days of like arena rock, and seeing the Bon Jovi videos where they're flying to different shows, and
oh my God, I know,
watching Motley Crue, you know, hanging out with stripper women and stuff. Like you get this picture that like rock stars are living the best life, have the most money, live in mansions, drive fast cars, fly private jets. And that might be a reality for like less than 1% of the bands. Were you making enough in the band that you didn't have to work, or were you like coming off tour and then going and doing something? Like I know I have some friends who were in 90s bands that were not anywhere near the level of success that you had, that when they toured, when the tour was done, they were waiting tables or working at bars or working at records. Like they were signed to a major label and they could barely afford their rent.
Yeah, that was true of a lot of bands. You know, for me, I was fortunate enough to not have to have a secondary job. But, you know, the way that our business was structured was not like conducive to longevity. So, yeah, like we stayed on the road for 3 years straight, almost 6 years straight, actually, you know. And so when I was off the road, yeah, I'd have a little bit of money to be able to pay my rent and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's how that worked. But then after the band broke up, I mean, that was a completely different story.
Sure.
And like I said, the way most bands were structured in those days was not conducive to longevity. They didn't like, a lot of us, we didn't have managers that like cared about who played the drums and cared about the fact that it was a 6-piece band or a 7-piece band. Like everybody needed to get paid, and
yeah,
we couldn't just play for however much money just to like keep padding your wallet, you know?
Yeah.
So the structure in those days was not great, but I was fortunate to not have to come home and like be spotted working, you know, at a department store or something like that. Not that it's not great work. Like sure. I've done it before and I love sales, but I just didn't have to do that because that would have been kind of weird. Yeah. Like, are you Monique Powell? I just saw you play last weekend. Oh my God. Yeah. What size shoe do you wear, ma'am? You know?
Right.
It just wouldn't have been appropriate at that time, but yeah. You know,
so it is what it is. I imagine that you were doing some like West Coast California touring in like maybe before you got signed or even like right when you got signed. When was the first time that you played outside of California? Like something a little bit extended, like were you doing any touring before signing with Epic? Were you getting out of California?
We were getting out of California, mostly West Coast touring. We didn't do much touring. I mean, we did van touring for a couple years, actually, before we got signed, now that I remember. But it was mostly Western U.S. because it was really hard to get into the rest of the country in a van and depending on the season. And God forbid it was like almost winter and you're in a van with a trailer and 8 other guys. And yeah, so... yeah, it was mostly Western U.S.
And then you signed with Epic, and then the expectation is that you go out on tour. What was eye opening to you about touring that like you hadn't really thought about? Was there anything that was sort of like, wow, I can't believe this?
Buses are really expensive, like really, really expensive.
And that comes out of that advance that you signed, right?
There you go. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Buses are really expensive. You got to pay for the driver. You got to pay for overages. You got to pay for gas. You got to pay for insurance.
That being said, was it kind of awesome to live the bus life though? Or was it?
So
it was
awesome.
Like, yeah.
It was so worth it. so worth it.
I saw.
I wouldn't trade any of it. Like even the bad stuff, I wouldn't trade any of it.
Yeah.
Honestly. Because I really... I have so many great stories to tell people now. I'm great at dinner parties because of it.
Bet.
Also, you have to pay for the bus driver. Like the bus driver doesn't sleep on the bus. The bus driver gets a really nice hotel room while the rest of us are like smelling because we don't have a shower on the bus. And we're like, get one shower room and we like all have to use it. So yes, it's very expensive.
So what were those tours like? I know, I mean, it's sort of a who's who of bands that you were playing with. You were opening for Sugar Ray, Offspring. I can't remember the other bands I saw on the list, but.
So 90s.
Yeah,
it's like so 90s. Yeah.
Like, were you friends with them? Maybe not in advance of the tours, but did you get to hang out with those bands, or were bands very kind of separate, you know, headliners show up just in time for soundcheck and play and leave? Or did you get a chance to kind of develop friendships with the bands that you were playing with?
Mark from Sugar Ray, Mark McGrath was a really nice, sweet person. I believe he was also from Orange County. And then the guys from The Offspring went to the same high school as my sister and I.
Oh, wow.
They graduated my sister's year. So Dexter and I had a couple conversations. I wouldn't say we became friends, but sure. But it was nice. It was nice, like, comparing notes with people. And I always made friends on the road. I think mostly, like, the Warped Tours that we did were, you know, just hanging out with all these great punk bands and, like, being able to become friends with all of those guys really was just amazing.
Yeah.
I love the way they see things. You know.
In the 90s, you may have felt differently, but looking back, was it like just like summer camp? Like, especially the Warped Tours where you're seeing the same people every day and hanging out with friends and
amazing.
And yeah. Did it ever feel like a job?
No, not, I mean, not for me, because if I like had a job that I didn't like, you know, like I wouldn't be permitted to like get drunk at work, like on the Warped Tour. It's like, do whatever. Hey, it's not work anymore. Whee! You know?
Yeah.
And also it was very, very, very hard touring. Don't get me wrong. It was hard.
Yeah.
But what was cool was that you get this like trauma bond with the other bands because we're all in the same trauma of this tour together. So we managed to like make something cool out of it. And the shows were great. And there was always thousands and thousands and thousands of people there to see the main stage in the 90s. And I felt like I was a part of something much bigger than myself. And I was because there's no other tours like it anymore. And bands right now cannot say that they've had the experience that I got to have three times in my career. So
I would suspect, you know, the 90s, having been around those times and all the alternative radio stations popping up, you had to have played radio station festivals too, where
a million.
Yeah.
And that was the greatest. I mean, it wasn't as great as Warped Tour, because Warped Tour, you actually create lasting friendships with people that you would never, ever become friends with any other way. Radio shows were like, I can say I played with David Bowie. What? I mean, I can say that, you know, I played with The Cure, you know, thanks to radio shows. Thank you, radio shows. You know,
and the other thing, right, with radio shows is, as opposed to Warped Tour, like the radio shows, the radio stations putting you on those shows are obviously going to be playing your music too. Like, it's like they want
people
to come out and see the bands that play. So
those 90s payola.
Yeah.
Radio shows were 90s payola.
Yeah.
Basically. If you didn't play the radio show, you couldn't get played on the station.
What was, Bowie and The Cure are amazing. What was like the weirdest, like the most, like the bill that you felt like you just either didn't belong on, or just like, how do we end up on a show with this band? Were there any situations like that?
Well, I think it was in 98, maybe it was 2000, but I can't remember which Warped Tour it was, but we went to Europe with the Warped Tour.
Oh, okay.
And they teamed us up with this like death metal festival. And so on one stage, it was Save Ferris. And then playing right after us was like Dimmu Borgir or like Cannibal Corpse or some shit. And I was just like, oh, get ready, folks. This is going to be awesome. You're going to hate Save Ferris. You are going to hate us. was in like Sweden or something, but I remember that was pretty dope. Yeah. I love seeing all the other bands, though. That was for sure.
I do want to talk about the cover of Come On, Eileen. Was that something that you guys had been working on prior to the label deal? Was it something that the label suggested? Was it something that you brought to the label and said you wanted to do? Like, how did the decision to do that song come about?
I had just remembered the song from when I was a kid growing up, and I really, really wanted to cover it because I love that song and it always made me happy. And so, yeah, so we were playing it live, and yeah, the label, after we got signed, was like, yeah, you should put that on the full length. And then we did. And then they decided to make it the first single.
I got to interview Kevin Rowland earlier this year, and
you did. How's he doing?
Good. He just put out a new record, and yeah. What was super interesting was, you know, I told him that it was so interesting to me to be talking to him, you know, whatever, 40 years after the single came out, and telling him that not only am I a fan, my mom is a fan, and my kids know all the words, and so like this being able to span generations. And he said, he's like, I appreciate that, but have you ever heard any of our other songs? And the reality, were it not for Spotify, my answer probably would have been no, but I have had a chance, you know, I go down those holes sometime where it's like, I wonder I listened to more Madness than I ever did back in the '80s when I didn't have the money to buy the records, or I only heard the singles. And so
yeah,
that I think that is a one, you know, if there's a benefit to the streaming platforms and stuff, it's the ability to check out stuff that otherwise I probably wouldn't have checked out. But yeah, my answer to him would have been, no, that I didn't know any of their songs.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I couldn't tell you the name of another Dexy song.
Yeah.
Although I have listened to their records and enjoyed them thoroughly, I can't say that I've studied the album to see who produced it and all of that. Like, you remember we used to do that with the CD?
Oh, absolutely.
Like get it and open it and the artwork's there and you get to see who produced everything and who played on what. And that was so cool.
My favorite thing in the pre-internet era was doing that and looking at the thank you list and trying to figure out, every once in a while, a band would like thank somebody that either I would, not that I would know personally, but like another band or somebody whose name I'd recognize, and always wondering like, why did they thank somebody that like, I couldn't figure out what the connection was. Like,
yeah,
you know, I thought that was kind of cool trying to figure out like why they would thank Robert De Niro.
Yeah. Or
something like that, right? Like why?
Yeah. Why? Why? Because we can. Because yeah. We can thank anybody we want in our thank you list.
Yes.
Santa Claus. So
I know I don't have the CDs anymore, but I did have the CDs in the 90s. I don't remember. Did you have thank you lists?
Yeah, you know, like there were seven people in the band and everybody had somebody to thank. So we only had so much space. So I don't remember really having any space for anything other than like my family and my close friends stuff. Yeah.
So this has been well documented. I'm not going to go down the whole path of like all the different legal things that you've been through, but between the first and second record and after the second record, was it still fun being in the band, or were things at a point where it was like getting uncomfortable? Like, was there ever any point in the late 90s, early 2000s where you thought about stepping away, or you thought that things weren't working out, that it just wasn't worth it?
Not really. I mean, and also, you know, the legal stuff hasn't really been well documented. I feel like it's very one-sided and not entirely truthful, you know, or factual.
Yeah.
Or truthful. Yeah, it stopped being fun for me in the end, but I always maintained hope that it would get better. You know, I was just kind of tired of I felt like so beat down by all of it, just being like really held under people's thumbs and being told what to do and what not to do and who not to be and how not to dress and how not to look. And it was just a lot, you know? So like, I never quit the band, and that was never a plan of mine, but I was tired. That's for sure.
was there a sea change in, like, I'm having a trouble remembering in the early 2000s where you were playing to smaller crowds? Like, did you start to see, just from a genre perspective, were things starting to change in that time period?
Well, that's been the kind of the thing about our scene and scenes in general that get this sort of push from radio and labels and stuff. We always manage to be a scene. Our shows, we maybe play smaller venues for a period, but then there's going to be an upswing again if you just stick with it. And I know this because I've watched other bands from our scene who, instead of taking a 10-year hiatus, like, continued to tour. And I mean, I have been clawing my way back since 2013. Yeah. And then with COVID and stuff, that definitely put a shit-stained ratchet in all of it. But so there's downswings, there's upswings. And yeah, I mean, grunge didn't help.
Yeah. And, you know, having to be selective. I mean, I'm guilty of that. Like, I loved 80s hair metal. The bigger the hair, the tighter the leather pants, the more I listen to it. You know, I love that stuff. And then grunge happened.
Yeah.
And it was so funny. I was talking to the guys on the Dig Me Out podcast about how I saw Bret Michaels from Poison play on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And I saw Nirvana play on a Thursday night. And my life literally changed. Like, I all of a sudden saw somebody that I connected to better.
Yeah.
And all I listened to prior to that was hair metal. I swore that stuff off for 10 years because I was like, that's stupid. And the nostalgia, I mean, you probably experience this now when you're playing shows, right? Like, now you're hitting people our age, mm-hmm. and they're nostalgic for the good old days of music. And mm-hmm. I just bought tickets to see Warrant play this coming summer at a 5,000 seat amphitheater. And, you know, it's probably going to sell out. And so, like, they've been through the ringer as well. And so I have to imagine that you're getting out there and playing now shows. Again, not necessarily for fun. I'm sure, like, there's more to it than just getting out there to have fun, but you're playing in front of people again.
Yeah, we are. But, and we've been able to sell out loads of shows that I never, ever expected that we would sell out. Again, you know, I've just been really bringing the band back after a period of, you know, inaction.
Yeah.
And so it's really great. But also, you know, I'm a fan of music too. Like, I'm a music fan, and you know, I love live music, and I try and approach everything I do from that perspective of, like, you know, there was a time when I didn't really like Save Ferris music anymore, you know, like, I moved past it, and now I love it again, and I love it for different reasons than I did before it. I find there's something so much bigger to what I'm doing than I knew about when I was in the 90s when I was a kid. Like, there's more to it now. There's a bigger story, and there's more importance. There's a different kind of importance for people to come to our shows. So
I'm actually really happy to hear you say that. Like, that you were able to reflect back and say, like, maybe I didn't like some of that stuff, but then come back around to figure out kind of why you did like it and fall back in love with it, which is really, that takes a lot of, I don't know a lot of people would admit that. So I think that's really cool.
You know, just because you're a parent doesn't mean you have to like your kids all the time. You know, you'll always love them, and they'll know you always love them, but it's okay to admit it. Like, sometimes, you know, I don't like my band, whatever, you know, sometimes I get tired of playing that same song over and over again, you know, but for me, this is like a whole new chapter. Everything's new. How everything is done business-wise is new. You know, how I dress, I can be creative with how I dress and my style and how I perform on stage, and I can be more free, and I know myself more now, and I'm not afraid to be honest anymore. And so the shows have a whole new, like, meaning for people, including myself. So
I'll try to wrap it up here, but I know that, you know, like I said, all those bands that I go see, a lot of them don't make new music because it's sort of like, what's the point, right? Like Warrant is not going to be on the radio. They're not going to get a new single charting. There's no MTV for them to play anymore. And so they tend to play old material. And then I have talked to other bands who are like, I never want to just stick to the old material. Like I always want to be creating. What camp do you fall into? And like, will we see, I know you said you're going to have a new single coming out soon, but will we see a new Save Ferris record in 2024 in the future?
I believe you will. I'm going to try and release a song and a video a month for the entire year. We'll see if I don't like lose my mind. But it's because, it's really, for me, it's just about fun content. And my boyfriend is a director. And so I have the luxury of like having cameras and good lighting at my disposal. So, and then I'm working with a producer named Michael Bradford, and he and I are constantly throwing songs back and forth. So there's no shortage of like creativity. And so yeah, there will be a full length, but
I'm friends with the guys in Blind Melon. I interviewed them when they first started, and in 2019, before the pandemic, they were kind of doing that same approach. They said, we'd rather put out a new song every month and have people get sick of them than drop 12 at one time and have you never even listen to songs 10, 11, and 12. And so we want to keep stuff fresh. And that seems to be a really smart approach, is keep a new song in people's ears until they get sick of it and then drop the next one.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And, but for me, it's also about like, again, like just having, it's the fun of having a release and finishing a song and, you know, maybe you'll enjoy this. If you didn't enjoy the last one, maybe you'll enjoy this one, and trying to sort of appease the masses in different ways and be creative. It's like a new form of creativity for me to like write. Like videos are not $2 million anymore. You can totally release videos like for nothing now.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I can write a treatment and film a video. Like for the Christmas song, we did that here at the house. Like that's the Christmas tree that was in it. Like we did it in a day. It was so much fun. So that's why I'm doing it.
Anybody from the Ferris Bueller movie ever reach out? Have you met any of them? Any acknowledgement from anybody in that camp?
Yes. Oh my God. The guy who says Bueller.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
Why is his name escaping me right now? Ben?
Ben. Was it Ben Stein?
Ben Stein.
Okay.
Perfect. Yes. Ben Stein. So when we released, I believe when we released It Means Everything, Ben Stein announced us. And that's awesome. He came out on stage and people lost their shit. It was pretty cool. And he was really nice too.
That's awesome. And because this is for a podcast about the 90s and it's about overlooked and underappreciated, I'm putting you a little bit on the spot. Is there any band that you really loved in the 90s that you think didn't get the acclaim and that should be talked about in the future, maybe even on this podcast?
Oh, wow. I think Phantom Planet was one of them, and another band called Marion.
Oh, Marion's from the UK?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a name I know, but I don't think I've ever listened
to
it.
That's crazy that you know who they are. Jellyfish.
Yeah.
Totally underappreciated.
Absolutely.
In my opinion. That's all I can think of right now, but no, that's I gave you three.
That's more than enough. Yes. I actually think Dig Me Out has reviewed at least the Jellyfish record maybe, but yeah, I'll throw those other two out to the host and see what they say about reviewing them.
Oh my God. I wonder if they've already covered Jellyfish.
They've done 680 episodes. So I'm guessing probably. They have, but I wonder if they've done. Yeah. Yeah, I'll go back and look.
Well, it took them long enough to get to Save Ferris. I mean, come on.
Well, like I said, you were 2014, so you were in the first 300, I think. So they reviewed the record in 2014, I think.
Oh, no kidding. Huh. All right.
Yeah, just look at
it. I forgive them.
Dig Me Out podcast. And like I said, I just listened to it again today just to kind of refresh myself. And they even said when they reviewed it that I think you were the first ska related record they did that they had just, that was a genre that they didn't know much about and they had not ever explored. And so, and like I said, in the review, they said that, had they listened to it in 1997, maybe it wouldn't have gotten a great review, cause it wasn't what they listened to, but with time, like, I think they definitely appreciated the sound and everything.
That is really cool. Yeah. Please thank them for me.
Absolutely will do. All right. So
and thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate you taking the time and good luck. Yeah. You know, we'll keep our eyes and ears open. SafeFerris.com, right? I think I saw that you just have that and you have all the different socials, Instagram.
On it all. All that stuff. Yeah. Right. You can just Google us.
Sounds awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.